Hello, and welcome to the Commonweal Policy Podcast. Welcome to 2023. Glad to have you with us. I'm Craig Diehl. I'm the Head of Policy and Research at Commonweal. In mid-2022, last year, the Scottish and UK governments agreed to create two new green free ports in Scotland. But it took until this month, January 2023, for them to publicly declare where they would be. They've announced that they will be in Cromarty and in Forth. Now, these ports have the outward mission of creating jobs and enabling the transition to net zero. But free ports historically and internationally have been linked to low pay and conditions, poor environmental standards, tax evasion, and outright illegal activities. My guest this week is tax expert Professor Richard Murphy. He's come along to tell us more about free ports and how this plan will affect the Scottish economy. Good to have you back, Richard.
Hello, and thanks for asking me back on a subject close to my heart, in a rather negative way.
Mm-hmm. Well, let's start then. Tell us, what is a free port? Can you give us a brief history of what they are?
Free ports have been around for a very long time. I mean, we can actually suggest they began in Italy in virtually the Middle Ages, where some of the individual city-states of Italy, as they were at that time, declared themselves free ports in the sense that goods could come and go without being subject to the taxes that were normally charged on imports and exports. And that was the origin of the free port idea. They were meant to facilitate trade. And of course, the great trading cities of the Mediterranean were absolutely fundamental to Italian prosperity at the time. And they were trying to get one up on each other. That last point, really important. One up on each other. Trying to claim an advantage over another one for a short period of time so they got more trade. But the idea continued sort of sporadically from the 1500s right down until 1958. Now, I happen to be quite fond of 1958 because I was born that year, but that isn't the event that we're talking about now. Now, that's the year that Ireland created the Shannon Free Port, which actually wasn't a port at all, unless you call an airport a port, because Shannon Airport had been the staging post for a decade or so for flights from Europe going to the USA when planes literally couldn't carry enough fuel to make the journey. So they landed in Shannon on the west coast of Ireland to refuel to do the hop over to somewhere like New York. As planes improved, they didn't need to land in Shannon anymore. And so Ireland, which was then just transitioning out of the desperate post-independence economic era that was dominated by the thinking of Eamon de Valera, was moved forward and saw the opportunity to create what he called a tax-free zone at Shannon Airport to encourage, in particular, non-commercial flights, literally goods, to come into and out of Europe via Shannon Airport, where there would be no taxes on import and export. So the zone around the airport was declared tax-free. Goods could be moved through there. No taxes were charged. It was regulation light. And this was the beginning of the Irish tax haven, which we still have today. And I should add, I have an Irish passport, and it doesn't make me popular when I say that in Ireland. So that was the modern origin, if you like, of the free port, created quite deliberately to abuse the laws of other places by allowing goods to move in and out of a country without taxes being paid. Every other free port since then has in some way worked on that same basis. There has always been some form of advantage provided by low taxation, usually to goods moving into and out of a country, but not necessarily, but almost always the case, and other relaxations of standards to try to make it easier for businesses to relocate into the free port and therefore attract business that would otherwise have gone to another town, city, or country to the place where the free port is to boost its economy. Now, that's the theory. I don't even approve of the theory here. The reason why I don't approve of the theory is that whilst I am a big fan of tax, and I think tax is incredibly important as an instrument for government to actually create the type of economy that we want for the benefit of everyone who lives in a country. Tax should not be used as a mechanism of artificially inducing competition. And the fact that tax has been used in this way has led to the race to the bottom in the standards of taxation around the world. So tax abuse has grown enormously since the 1950s, with the growth of the tax haven, which has been enormous since the 1950s and 60s, largely promoted by the UK, but also by Ireland. And tax should not be used to induce these artificial relocations of business, which has been such a characteristic of tax haven trade. Now, because I object to that, I therefore think that these things are actually positively harmful. And that's evidenced by what we see in the data. Organizations like the OECD, organizations like the European Union, both of whom have free ports throughout their membership, including in the EU, where free ports are quite common and in some countries absolutely incredibly significant. For example, in Luxembourg, or on the borders of the EU, there are significant free ports. The largest and most significant in terms of impact is actually probably that in Geneva in Switzerland. These free ports are associated with a number of things. First of all, deep, dark, impenetrable trading, very largely in high value goods, much of which may be undertaken fraudulently, or with fraudulent intent, for example, for money laundering purposes. The Geneva Freeport, for example, is thought to hold well over 1 million works of art. And it has been suggested in academic and other literature that many of those pieces of art are held, first of all, anonymously, every single one of them owned by an individual offshore company, the ownership of which can't be traced. Secondly, without tax. And thirdly, quite possibly in some cases, for money laundering, because who knows how the value of a piece of art can be readily determined. And so you can knock up a piece of art and pay somebody £1,000 for it, then claim it's worth 5 million, and as a result, inflate the value for money laundering purposes and pay for a work of art which isn't in any way worth the money it really is claimed to be, but in that way launder illegal funds. Now, all of these.
How is it that you end up with these illegal activities? It's just a case of if nobody's checking for the legitimate tax because they're not allowed to, there's just no resources to look for the illegitimate stuff either.
Well, if you say there is no regulation in the freeport, what goes on there is, so long as nothing ever leaves the freeport, so goods can come in and leave the freeport, but never actually theoretically, therefore, enter the country where the freeport is located, which would be true with regard to Geneva. The artwork comes in by private plane, is dumped in the freeport, it sits in the freeport, it might never leave again. I think very large quantities of that supposed art, whether it's any good or not, might never leave that freeport. It's there purely for the purposes of literally financial engineering. But if it did leave, it would move straight out of the freeport, straight onto another plane, leave again. And Switzerland would never have had the opportunity, because it's passed laws that says it hasn't got that chance, to literally look at what's happened inside the freeport. So basically, this type of structure is created to say, we don't ask questions. Now, that's a very common European style of freeport. And I have to say that quite specifically, the UK's legislation on this, and it is UK legislation that is going to control the Scottish freeports, does ban trading in works of arts. It doesn't ban trading in some other things like vintage cars, or potentially whiskey, which may be subject to the same sort of manipulation. Suddenly, we might find some whiskies are worth an incredible amount of money, which... who knows whether that's true or not? It doesn't ban trading in some other things like precious metals, which could also be exploited for these sorts of purpose. So works of art are excluded, but other things are not. So they are commonly used for money laundering. But if we go to other areas where there are free ports, they're also very commonly associated, particularly in developing countries and also in China, where they are quite common. If you buy clothes from China, particularly, I won't mention brands, I think that's inappropriate, but some clothes from China are definitely made in free ports. They're associated with very low labor standards, very low environmental regulation, sometimes straightforward abuse of human rights, and maybe with human trafficking in some cases, that's certainly been documented. So they are basically areas which are beyond the law. There is no regulation. Or if there is regulation, it's delegated to the private company that is given the task of running the freeport. So we effectively have places which are company fiefdoms, if you like. And that is one of the risks of the free ports inside the UK and inside Scotland, that they are actually going to be run by companies who are going to be given the responsibility for administering regulation within those zones. And that's a pretty scary prospect. The chance that things can go wrong when governments deliberately turn a blind eye to regulation is very high indeed. And I think for that reason, freeports are essentially, by design, places that are dangerous because they could be literally the location for outlaw activity, where outlaw means beyond the law.
Given all of that, why are some politicians enamoured with the idea of freeports?
Politicians, you must remember, inside countries with relatively small political constituencies, are desperately keen to relocate economic activity into their constituency, to claim they have done the right thing for their own electorate, those who will put them back in parliament. And I think that a great many politicians in developed countries have been subject to the lure of the freeport because it might help their re-election campaigns. And I'm being cynical by saying so, but why wouldn't I be? Freeports are often in places in need of development of some sort. Not always. I have to say, I can see no reason why the Port of Felixstowe needs to be a freeport at present. The county of Suffolk, where it's located, is not poor. It doesn't need redevelopment. It's already the biggest port in the country. What on earth is the reason for making it a freeport? Similarly, Southampton, etc. But there are places in the past where, in particular, this activity has been used to try to promote an area which has been run down. And you could argue that's the case now with the North East Freeport in England, which is running, which is based around the Tees Valley, Middlesbrough, and so on, which is a pretty deprived area. So there are politicians who are very keen on it for that reason. And there are others who are keen on freeport simply for dogmatic reasons. They hate regulation of all sorts, and they see this as an opportunity to basically undermine the regulatory system of the country, to import low levels of regulation, low standards of employment protection, low standards of environmental care into the country so people get used to it, and then they can move on and make them general for application everywhere. So one is either particular self-interest or the other one is an assault on all the standards that maintain good standards of living in our country. For those who, you know, where we're talking about particular locations and particular politicians, I think it has to be understood how freeports work. The evidence is incredibly strong that freeports do not create new jobs. All that freeports appear to do is move jobs from locations elsewhere within the country where they might otherwise be. Now, there are exceptions where they might move jobs from other countries altogether, but I think that is very, very unlikely in the case of a UK freeport or a Scottish freeport. What we will see is that Forth and Cromarty, I feel like I'm doing a shipping forecast when those two are chosen. Just seems like an uncomfortable coincidence. But when those two are, you know, up and running as freeports, we may well see some jobs move from elsewhere in Scotland into those freeports. Will there be any net new jobs as a result? The evidence for that is very low. And let's be clear, we have some evidence on that from the UK. Freeports have been tried in the UK before. They appeared, you know, I actually can't remember, was it John Major or Margaret Thatcher who introduced them in the late 80s, early 90s? And they continued right through the Labour years and were finally abandoned by David Cameron in 2012 on the basis that freeports and the model that was used at that time generated no new jobs of any consequence, net overall, and had a cost and were of no obvious contribution to the economy as a whole. So they were scrapped. I mean, It's bizarre, isn't it? It's only a decade ago. The Tories scrapped Freeports, now they're back again. The same arguments being used on both occasions. I don't believe there will be any net new jobs as a result of these Freeports. But what will we see? We will see an increase in the complication of regulation. I know that. I'm a chartered accountant, and I look at tax regulation, and there are whole new tables of tax data that now exist inside our tax system to manage the taxes due by employees working in Freeports because they have different rates of national insurance. We are offering lower rates of tax to employers in particular who are employing people inside Freeports. In other words, the cost of labour inside these places has been deliberately reduced to encourage jobs to be relocated within them. The biggest beneficiary that I can identify at present is BP. Why we need to subsidise BP when they are recording record profits because of a global energy crisis, which is working to their benefit incredibly well, I don't know. But they are locating their hydrogen activities in the northeast Freeport around Middlesbrough, and they will be benefiting from this lower cost of paying their staff as a result. So we know that there is an additional complication and there is a reduction in cost to very large companies in the main who will be relocating into Freeports. So these things are actually going to add complications, and they are going to result in more complex tax laws rather than less complex tax laws. And that is something which, again, is against the whole apparent principle of Tory thinking and yet is happening under their rule.
It is a great irony to me that, especially in the Scottish context, we're having all these arguments about the impact of a border between Scotland and England, and yet one of the impacts of these free ports is a multitude of customs borders being drawn around the ports. And as we'll get onto in a bit later, it's more than that, because these free ports are not single locations. But you're going to have to draw multiple customs borders to prevent goods leaking from the free port out into the rest of the economy.
Well, that is one of the other major problems we've got with Freeports. I'm actually supervising a PhD student at the moment who's looking into Freeports. That is the subject of their doctoral thesis. And one of the things they and another person who I know who works at a university other than the one where I'm located, Sheffield, they've both been actually doing some on-the-ground research on the Freeports that have already been created. And as you say, Craig, these things are not simple areas, geographic areas drawn around a port. Yeah, you can't just say, oh, there's the port, and we'll say that the boundary of the port is where the Freeport ends. Oh, no. Freeports can actually cover a very large geographic area. And they can be little isolated warehouses spread right across that whole geographic area, with a border, therefore, appearing here and there and everywhere else. Now, how do you work out where the Freeport is? And in fact, that's what they've done some on-the-ground work looking at, particularly in the Northeast, because that one happens to be well-developed, relatively speaking. And they couldn't find any geographic indication of where the border was. Now, that's significant. Because if we can't identify where the borders are, and yet taxes change on that border, how do we know we can stop abuse within the border and outside the border? And how do we know that an employer is correctly saying, oh, I'm employing this person within the Freeport, when actually they could be employing them outside the Freeport? And what do you do about the person who drives the truck that moves the items into the Freeport and then out again? Are they employed in the Freeport? Or are they employed outside the Freeport? Is half their pay, whilst they're inside the Freeport, subject to the Freeport rules and half not? Nobody knows the answers to these questions yet, to be totally honest. And actually, the rules around this are incredibly vague. Right from the start, when these Freeports were announced, just a couple of so years ago, and I took part in the public consultations on it, I was one of only two people from civil society who went to most of the consultations that were hosted by the government on this issue. So great was the interest at the time, but I went. And they basically could give almost no guidance on what the rules meant. They said, if you can imagine it's possible, presume it is. Now, things have changed, and I should mention this. Liz Truss was a big fan of Freeports. Rishi Sunak has been the biggest exponent of free ports. But it's also become apparent that there has been a change of heart around free ports after the collapse of the Truss regime. And in fact, Jeremy Hunt appears to be responsible for this. Although, again, everything is vague at the moment. Whereas it seemed that free ports were going to be available to cover a whole wide range of activities and they were going to be around conventional ports, it's now being said that free ports will in the future, but what does the future mean? And does this therefore apply to the two new free ports in Scotland? They will be located around, well, second-tier universities to encourage the creation of technologies which are transferring from design stage or research stage inside the university to design and delivery stage in a free port where people would be employed near the university. Now, that seems to be a change of heart. Those are just technology hubs. But is that what they're talking about? Again, the vagueness is one of the great difficulties of this whole scheme. We don't know the rules. And because we don't know the rules, we don't know whether anybody's enforcing the rules and how they're going to change and be monitored and regulated and so on. But we do know abuse is happening. A lot of people might have noticed the furore about the dredging that is going on around the Freeport, again in the northeast of England, where very large numbers of shellfish and other types of fish appear to be being, well, literally killed by the process of dredging, where toxic chemicals are being released, which does hint at one of the other problems. Is this whole exercise designed to undermine environmental regulation? Again, we don't know, but it would appear possible that that's the case. However, as the Private Eye magazine witnesses, I think, in almost every edition that it publishes, finding out anything about what's going on inside that freeport is nigh on impossible because it's run by private companies, very closely associated, it seems, with the mayor's office for that area, but very impenetrable to find out what's going on. I'm not saying anything is definitely going wrong. I'm not accusing anybody of any wrongdoing. All I'm saying is we can't find out. And I don't believe that's how regulation should be managed.
Mm. It is worth stressing again the decentralized nature of these things, because it's once in the Scottish case, at least in the UK case, once the central locus has been decided for these free ports, companies, I think, up to 45 kilometres away from that locus can apply to be part of the freeport. And I started mapping the shortlist for the Scottish freeports when they were still deciding them. Discovered that had the winners been Forth, which did win, and Prestwick, which did not win, it would have taken the entire central belt of Scotland into the freeport zone,
yeah,
with the exception of my village. There was a narrow corridor running up the M74 and like 5 kilometres to the east of me and 7 kilometres to the west, there was a narrow corridor there that was not in the freeport zone.
So now you're acting like a typical politician and complaining you're not in the free port, Craig. No, I don't think that's...
No, I wanted to put a toll road in the M74.
Ah, that would have been... But, you know, this is the problem, yeah, that we just don't know. And if they are that big, and they really are being drawn very widely at the moment, whether that will be the case in the future, if they do more of these things, we don't know. But they are being drawn very widely. In that case, you know, you can find little, as I said, sheds, warehouses, call them what you will. I've run companies out of sheds in my time. I'm quite happy about that. They were doing things perfectly legitimately where they were located. But, you know, suddenly to find that they are actually in what is called a free port and that different rates of tax apply is very strange indeed. And indeed, you know, this could be for all sorts of reasons that companies could apply to be in these areas. And I just don't believe that's reasonable.
So how much can you tell us about the Scottish version of these freeports? They're being deemed green freeports. What's your understanding about the green bit?
Greenwashing, I think, is the only thing we can honestly say. You know, you and I know, both share a commitment to green causes, Craig, and have done for a long time. What can be green about making products which increase consumption inside a location where it is deliberately designed that the return to capital will be higher, the return to labor will be lower, and the environment will be abused to achieve this outcome. I don't see how that can ever be considered to be green. Green to me necessarily involves processes which shift emphasis from product to services, which require high levels of regulation to make sure that there is a consistency of standards where the environment is protected, and where there is an inherent respect for the role of people within the economy being absolutely fundamental to the creation of the sustainable society that we want to live in. And none of those things seem consistent with the idea of a green Freeport, which seems to undermine them all. So why these are being labeled green to me is frankly a little absurd. I hope Green Party politicians in Scotland haven't been seduced into this to think it's okay. But there does appear to be some element to that. And I hope this isn't being used by the Holyrood Parliament or the Holyrood government as a whole to argue, well, these aren't the same as the Freeports in the rest of the UK, and as a form of political posturing, when frankly, the difference will be minute as far as I can see. I don't see what relevance the word green has in front of these at all. You can argue
I should say just for clarity, the Scottish Green Party has come out very much against the Freeport idea, and it is one of the policy areas that is excluded from the coalition deal between the Greens and the SNP. However, there are MSPs from other parties that are in favour of the Freeports, including in the Scottish government.
Yes, absolutely, there are. And OK, I accept the point about the Green Party, but they need to be opposed to it and the greenwashing that is going on. And remember that many things which are labelled green are pretty dubious for this purpose. For example, again, I'm going back to that one in the northeast of England. It's the one I probably know most about. But it is the one which is really at the moment in the lead in trying to create a distinct role for itself. Hydrogen is at the core of the product there. Now, BP will claim that's a green product, but there is a lot of controversy about the green status of much hydrogen production. And I don't think it follows that just because a company claims it's green means it is green. And I think we will be seeing a great deal of abuse of that term in the course of the development of these Freeports.
It seems to me, and I'm coming at this from a relatively unexpert point of view, that one of the things that they're touting these green Freeports for is the construction of renewable energy, so wind turbines. But if the idea of a Freeport is it allows you to import components, build things, and then export the final goods without having to bother about tax and regulation, then the corollary of that is exporting wind turbines might be a good thing for Scotland, but it also means that you can't use those wind turbines in Scotland without having to then negotiate bringing the goods into the real economy. So is it really benefiting Scottish renewable sector to be building wind turbines that you're not allowed to use in Scotland?
Well, if you get economies of scale, I guess the answer to that could be yes. But let's ask the other questions about what the benefit is to the Scottish economy, because, you know, somebody's got to make up the taxes that aren't paid. And actually, some of those taxes that aren't going to be paid are actually local authority taxes, because there are also reduced business taxes, council equivalents of business taxes. And who's going to make good those? Again, I'm not quite sure how that's actually being negotiated. Who's making good the loss of revenues potentially to the Scottish government arising from these issues? Again, it won't be clear how that actually works. There may not be much to the Scottish government because of the nature of the devolved tax settlement, but anybody who is involved in considering the overall impact on the Scottish economy needs to know answers to those questions. And at the moment, I haven't seen those answers. There doesn't appear to be a compensation package for those who might be losing out by the provision of specific tax subsidies in specific areas, which might be at cost to the local communities of those places in some instances. So I think we need to be quite careful about those things and be sure about that. So, yeah, it could be that a wind turbine made as in a factory which is being slightly subsidised with regard to export activity could benefit the Scottish renewable industry. But is it going to benefit it enormously? No, because I think Scotland would have a competitive advantage with regard to production of wind turbines anyway, if only it had a government that was actually able to provide the level of support that's really desirable to the Scottish wind industry, which we know could be incredibly significant, but which is being constrained by lack of funding from Westminster to Holyrood to pass on for this purpose. So there could be a much better way of providing this direct intervention to support specific green goals than is actually happening.
Now, taking that, you just mentioned the impact on local authority tax revenue, but if we take that and then zoom out to Scotland-wide revenue and zoom out to the entire UK, given the economic and financial trouble the UK is in at the moment, is this the right time to be taking vast swathes of the country out of the tax system?
I don't mind the use of, as I said before, taxation as a way of delivering industrial policy. And I think a country should have an industrial policy. For example, I do think there should be subsidies to green industry. But I think it should be very specific. And actually, I'm not even sure it should be through the tax system. Why not give a direct grant? Because then you actually know how much you're spending who with, and you're targeting it to the people who might be able to use it best. The tax system is incredibly poor at targeting these types of subsidies. It randomly spatters cash across all sorts of activities, some of which might be very undesirable, in the hope that some might be of benefit. So is this the time to actually splash the cash in this way? No, probably not. The cash should be better spent through industrial investment banks, which are set up for regional and national purposes, and not by just giving out tax subsidies willy-nilly.
Now, if we did just take ourselves away from Freeports for a moment, because there's been a lot else going on in the financial world, and probably I could spend the next couple of questions. I could get you back on a dedicated podcast for each one of them, but we'll try and be brief. You've spent years tracking HMRC's tax gap. In fact, your reports on that were probably, I think, how I found out about you and your work. Can you tell us about the recent report into the lost revenue that HMRC is not collecting, and how much of the current cost of living crisis could have been averted if they were doing their job?
The tax gap is the difference between the amount of tax that HM Revenue and Customs thinks should be paid if everybody complied with UK tax law, and the amount of tax that is paid. I have always been intensely critical of HM Revenue and Customs' estimate of the tax gap, for two reasons. One, I don't think somebody should mark their own homework. There is always, therefore, an incentive for management to say every year, didn't we get better? How clever of us. And there have been changes almost every year since 2010, when the annual publication of the tax gap series by HM Revenue and Customs began, a couple of years after I wrote my first major report on the subject, which have always mysteriously seemed to reduce the tax gap. How very odd, I think. The tax gap also always and mysteriously appears to be a number remarkably close to £35 billion and has been ever since the first report was prepared. In fact, if you take a range between £30 billion and £40 billion, I think we're just talking at the high end at the moment, because things have got a bit worse right now because too many HM Revenue and Customs staff were diverted to COVID-related issues. We're always talking about a number in that range. But the percentage of total taxes paid has always been declining with a fixed number for the tax gap. Now, the tax gap is manipulated, and I'm not the only person to say that. The IMF noted this when they did a review of the way in which HM Revenue and Customs work out the figures, because our tax authority assumes that if you don't send in a tax return, basically you've got no tax to report, which I would call intensely naive. Because actually, the best way to not disclose your tax liability is to not send in a tax return, I suggest. And just to give an example of how easy this is, you can buy a company in the UK for £12. No signatures required, no proof of identification required. You can trade that company for 18 months. You need never tell any authority that you are trading it. You then fail to file accounts. You fail to file a tax return. And the authorities very conveniently then decide, oh, you must have never traded. Therefore, they'll, as they call it, strike your company off and you'll never have to owe the taxes that you have fraudulently pocketed. There are potentially 2 million companies about which we know almost nothing in the UK at present who could be owing tax, and as far as we know, aren't. And we don't know why. And in many cases, the revenue won't be asking them for tax returns. And that's where the big missing tax is, in my opinion. We have a country which basically runs an out-of-control corporate registry system. We have no enforcer of company law in the UK, nobody to check what's going on. And therefore, I believe that if we started from the top of the economy, in other words, looked at GDP and worked our way down through the economy and said how much should be paid for all taxes, income taxes, national insurances, corporation taxes, and so on, we would find that the total tax loss is vastly bigger than the revenue say. I think it's much nearer to 100 billion. Now, they disagree with me. We've exchanged opinion on this many times, and I have done with many ministers over the years, and they always refuse to agree I'm right. I did advise the European Union on its VAT gap estimates last year. So it does seem as though some people think I have credibility in the area. Otherwise, I guess I wouldn't have been asked to do that sort of work for the EU. They tend to come up with slightly higher estimates for the VAT gap. They only look at VAT for Europe than the UK has always done for itself. The UK has, of course, now fallen out of that data set because it's no longer in Europe. They finally dropped the UK, but historically they always came up with bigger figures, and they used a better methodology of the type I've just explained. So we are losing vast amounts of money because it's been decided that HM Revenue and Customs, like every government department, should be subject to austerity and therefore have the number of staff working for it reduced and have the number of highly paid staff working for it reduced. But the number of people we really have who are able to actually now undertake proper tax investigations, and HM Revenue and Customs is quite low. The number of audits of tax abusers is going down. They tend to pick the easiest cases, therefore tax abuse is rising. How much extra could we raise a year? Look, it depends, first of all, whether we get the estimate of the tax lost right. If we just say it's around 40 billion, for every £1 spent on tax investigations by HM Revenue and Customs, £18 on average is raised. So suppose we spent another billion at HM Revenue and Customs and increased its cost, annual cost of running it, from roughly 3.5 billion to 4.5 billion, we could raise another 18 billion quid in tax. Maybe. Why not? I think that's entirely plausible. What would that do for us right now? I think it would make a massive transformation, for example, to the NHS. That would be one simple way of achieving that outcome. Right across the UK, that would make good the shortfall in spending that has taken place since 2010 as a result of Tory austerity, having taken into consideration the fact that if you increased the spend to the level required, there will be a lot of extra tax paid by NHS staff anyway. Now, the point I'm making is there is lots of money available in a pot. It could be bigger than that. But why we take the attitude we must cut expenditure on collecting tax when we're actually spending more on collecting tax not only improves the quality of the service to honest taxpayers in this country, but also eliminates the cheat to undermine honest businesses in this country and therefore improves the quality of the market in this country. But it also improves the public revenue. I just don't know. It seems particularly perverse that the Tories have been dedicated to cutting spending on tax collection when it absolutely serves their own economic purpose of promoting free and fair markets.
And it's probably a reason why folk like tax inspectors and, no offence to your profession, Richard, but accountants, even back to the invention of writing, have not always been the most praise heaped upon profession, is because it's quite profitable business. And given that accountants invented writing, those records go back quite far.
Indeed they did. We can go back to Babylon, and the first written records are of taxes owing. Isn't that amazing?
So, very final question, and again, one of these quick ones that could be a podcast in itself. What is going on at the Bank of England? They're looking at the economic data, they're looking at the inflation spike, they're looking at people not getting the not getting wage rises. The ONS was saying, okay, there has been technically record wage rises in nominal terms, but it's still a wage cut in real terms. And the Bank of England took that, looked at the top figure and think, well, we need to hammer the workers again. What is going on?
I call it economic civil war, targeted from Threadneedle Street in London, where the Bank of England is, against the rest of the population of the UK, solely to benefit the banking community and those who have enormous wealth in this country. Let's be blunt. What are they doing? All the evidence is that inflation is going to tumble in 2023. Simply because, and we're already seeing it. I mean, the trend is very marked in the US already. It's beginning here. As we move into the period when we're comparing prices after the start of Putin's war with prices that were also after the start of Putin's war, i.e. when they spiked because of the start of that war, we will see inflation begin to fall heavily, because inflation is simply a measure of the movement in prices from one year to the next. It isn't a measure of absolute price changes. Prices are still going to remain high where they are now, but they aren't going to keep going up by the same level. So inflation is going to disappear. In fact, official forecasts say it's going to be negative in 2024. Deflation. There could be falls in prices even. Not very much, so don't hang your hope on this in a big way. But the Bank of England says, oh, we can't be sure we've beaten inflation yet. We have to make sure that people don't ask for compensation for the fact that their cost of living has fallen. Oh, sorry, the cost of living has risen, therefore their standard of living has fallen. They mustn't be compensated for this. Large companies can have extra profits as a result. Oil companies can be coining it in, and banks most definitely are coining it in because of the increase in interest rates, which the Bank of England says have not stopped as yet. And most people think they're going up by at least another 1.5% this year, meaning that millions of households across the UK and vast numbers in Scotland will be forced into destitution, unable to work out how to pay their mortgages. And that spills over directly into rent costs, because a lot of landlords have very high mortgages on rental properties, and they apparently want all this to punish us for the absolute nerve people have got of asking for a pay rise to compensate them for the fact that their real standard of living has fallen depending upon where they work. If they work in the private sector, on average last year their standard of living fell by 3%. If they worked in the state sector, their average of living last year fell by almost 7%. Now, you can see why most of the disputes are in the state sector as a result, because they're being punished particularly hard. But why the Bank of England wants to declare this economic war on working people, I don't know. But what it does do is guarantee recession. We absolutely are guaranteed recession if people don't have the money to spend. That guarantees us rising unemployment and failing businesses, because people will not be going out. They won't be buying coffees. They won't be going out to the cinema. They won't be going to the pub. They won't be going wherever else. They won't be buying clothes. So the economy is going to go into a downturn. And that could in turn lead to a housing crisis, because there won't be the money to spend on housing and the prices will begin to fall. Now, you could say that's great, and to some extent that's fine, and house prices need to fall, but in a very managed way, because if they tumble, then you actually have a banking crisis, because banks don't have the security for their loans. You could actually see this as the worst economic decision making in, well, perhaps a century going on right now at the Bank of England. The surest way to create an economic crisis rather than a simple economic headache that we've now got. I think we're heading for the most torrid 2023, and I can put the blame entirely on one person, Andrew Bailey, Governor of the Bank of England, who appears to have absolutely no comprehension of how the economy works and what he needs to be doing to fulfil his mandate, which he only has to sit still and do nothing, and he will deliver inflation of 2% by the end of this year. But instead, he's going to ruin the economy for no good reason. You might get that I'm a little bit angry about this, Craig.
Well, I was going to say, on that happy note, I'm sure we will get you back on a future policy podcast to discuss the fallout from those decisions as well. Thank you, Richard. It's been a fascinating chat, as always.
Thank you very much.
And I would just like to end the podcast by telling everyone that Commonweal as an organisation is entirely funded by our donors and supporters, who give us an average of £10 a month. We don't have big corporate sponsors. We don't get government money. We are not located in a freeport to get the tax breaks from it. We are entirely reliant on folk like yourself to produce our policies, to produce our campaigns, and to produce this podcast. So if you can help us, please, please, please click the donate button in the description of the podcast. Thank you, everyone, for listening. Thank you, everyone, for sharing the podcast. Thank you, everyone, for coming back this year. And I'll speak to you all next week. Thank you.